This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of the ESV Spiral Bound Journaling Bible. This Bible was created from the ground up in order to facilitate in-depth note-taking. I know there are a lot of people out there that love to take notes in their Bible. They want to take notes when the preacher's preaching. They want to take notes at their Bible study. They want to take notes in their own personal study. And this is a great way to do it. It's divided into five individual volumes: Pentateuch, historical books, poetry, prophets, and the New Testament. So that's a complete ESV text. It's an easy-to-read layout. Lots of space for notes, and of course the spiral bound makes it really easy. You know, when you're trying to write in a book and you gotta lay your elbow on it, so this just lays out flat. So journaling is your thing, note taking is your thing, this is an ideal resource to do it. Write down your notes, your thoughts, your prayers, your reflections. You can find the ESV Spiral Bound Journaling Bible wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/spiralboundbible to learn how you can get 30% off with the free Crossway Plus account. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast, as they have for many years. If you are already struggling a bit to stick to your goals and resolutions for 2026, I always like making resolutions. I know that's not everyone's thing, but it's a good time of year. Calendar turn, you got some new initiatives, you want to read better, you want to memorize some scripture, you want to introduce fasting into your regimen. You may have some goals like that, as I do, and they get hard quickly. You can join Desiring God for Every Good Resolve. This is a new video series with David Mathis on building habits that feed your faith. You'll be reminded the pursuit of joy is vital to producing life-changing habits. There's lots of good stuff just out in the broader world about habits, but we always want to remember as Christians, why are we forming these habits? And what really is the power and the fuel for these habits? This new series, Every Good Resolve, is a practical biblical guide, lots of good tips on how to form these life-giving routines and habits, and David Mathis is a good guide for you. So you can join DG for Every Good Resolve now at desiringgod.org/resolve. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, the senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, right next door to Charlotte, North Carolina, and I am talking to a special guest, a returning guest, a fellow North Carolinian, Neil Shenvey. Welcome back to LBE. You are still in North Carolina, correct?
I am. I'm in Durham. Now it's 27 degrees here. It was 75 3 days ago, so you know how it is.
I know. One of my kids went with her friends to the UNC game, basketball game, over the weekend. It was first time, and that's not Durham, that's Chapel Hill, but first time being over there. But, you know, it's not Charlotte, but it's pretty country over there.
It's a nice area.
How long have you been there?
Oh, man, 16 years now. I came down from New Haven, Connecticut, as Yale. It was a change in scenery and change in weather, definitely.
Now, I know I asked this before, but yeah, you were at Cal and then Yale. So where were you born?
I was born in, I was born in California, but my family moved to Delaware when I was like 18 months old. So I grew up on the, you know, mid-Atlantic states, went to school at Princeton, then Berkeley, then New Haven, and my wife went to Yale, and then we're down here at UNC area.
Did you come from, that's an impressive list of schools, although most of them are the subject of this book that is woke.
like every school these days, you know.
Like every school. Was this is this part of your family heritage? Is this just how you were brought up?
Yeah, I got from my dad, my love of science and math. And from my mom, she's a language teacher. And so I got from her my love of literature and I guess just like language in general. I guess now I'm a writer. So I do have both backgrounds.
That's great. We are talking about Neil and Pat's new book, Post Woke, Asserting a Biblical Vision of Race, Gender, and Sexuality, just come out by Harvest. And Pat was supposed to be with us. He's under the weather, so we wish our brother and friend a speedy recovery.
He sends his apologies. He had food poisoning all weekend. It was brutal, so he wished he could be here, but he said to say hello to you.
Okay, well, I hope he'll be post-food poison very soon. Let me just set this by reading, and I have read the book, and I really like the book, and this is what I say about here's my blurb, just to give our listeners an idea of what they're in for. This book is a great introduction to and refutation of wokeness, what Shenvey and Sawyer define, and I'm going to ask you to extrapolate on this, define as the contemporary cultural expression of critical theory. To put it more plainly, this book is about race, gender, and sexuality, what our culture would have us believe about all three, and by contrast, what the Bible teaches about each. With clear writing, careful research, and calm evaluation, Shenvey and Sawyer have provided an articulate and accessible resource that will serve students, schools, pastors, and churches, and really any Christian living in the West for years to come. If someone asks me, what is wokeness and what is wrong with it, this is the first book I'll recommend. So I want to start there. What is wokeness and what is wrong with it?
That's a great blurb. Thank you again for your endorsement. It's a great summary. We use that on the front cover of the book.
Oh, I'm honored.
So wokeness, as we said, it's the outward expression of a set of ideas that are under the surface. So we kind of look around in culture, and most people have said there's something out there that we can term wokeness, whether it's drag queen story hour, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's Queers for Palestine, whether it's Blue's Clues featuring a drag queen singing songs about non-binary beavers who had their breasts removed. There are all these crazy manifestations of wokeness in the culture.
That's a true example.
These are all straight up true examples we footnote in the book. But people sometimes think that's just a weird left-wing progressive zeitgeist. It comes from nowhere. It's just a fad. But what we show in our book is that, these expressions are just symptoms of a deeper underlying ideological disease that we term contemporary critical theory that has its roots going all the way back to Karl Marx. And we say, well, what does it matter? These ideas these expressions are obviously wrong and unbiblical. Well, yes, but if you don't understand the ideas, you'll be treating the symptoms without addressing the underlying cause, like slapping a Band-Aid on someone's, gangrenous limb and hoping it'll get better. It won't. You have to go deeper and really excise the tumor, to mix metaphors there. But I think that's what we're trying to do in the book, is show you, number one, what the ideas are, number two, how they contradict the biblical ideas about race, gender, and sexuality, and then three, how to push back against these ideas and to show people that the Bible offers a vision of race, gender, and sexuality that is both true, good, and beautiful.
When did woke come to have these strong connotations? It's a word that's been around longer than 2019. Mm-hmm. And at least some of the origin story, I think, is from African-American community and seeing, okay, somebody sort of has their eyes open to the plight of African Americans or race, which may or may not have had any critical theory elements to it. It may have just been a general sort of colloquialism. There's someone who kind of sees some things they didn't see before, but over time it has really morphed to mean something much more nefarious. When did that happen? And is it now just conservatives who are labeling things woke, or are there people embracing the term still for themselves?
Yeah, it's a very long and tortuous history. So the word itself, as you said, goes back to the 1920s, in fact. It's a blues singer, who just talked about staying woke. And again, it was a sort of black vernacular that expressed awareness of racism and injustice in the culture, which definitely existed. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of got revamped. I think in 2010 or so, there was a singer, I think it was Erykah Badu, a hip hop singer, who talked about stay woke. It was a phrase in one of her songs. That was, I think, around 2010 or so. But in the 2010s, progressives actually began to adopt that term as a self-identifier. They said, we are woke. There's actually a paper called We Are Woke, mm-hmm. written by three women of color, WOMXN, where they define wokeness as a critical consciousness that's aware not only of racism, but of heterosexism, sexism, transphobia, all of these isms that you now associate with wokeness. But that was a term that was, you could argue that progressives unfairly co-opted it from the black community, but they did do that. And if you go back on Internet Archive and look at the 2010s, sure enough, lots and lots of progressives, including LGBTQ activists, post-colonial activists, they adopted that terminology for themselves. And then only later, after the progressives had claimed it as their own, did then conservatives begin calling all of these ideas woke. But again, I would say, well, that was a response to them identifying a real phenomenon that was being labeled as woke by its purveyors. So we always say, it doesn't matter what you want to call it. If you want to call it wokeness, that's fine. If you want to call it cultural Marxism, that's fine. But there is a phenomenon out there that is real, that's rooted in these ideas that's been found, that have been found in the academy for a century and a half. So our goal is to not get focused on labels, but to instead address the underlying ideas and show why they're unbiblical.
And I think what you said there is really important. You have the labels, and you have some elements that are maybe faddish, some of the, you know, the most bizarre extreme examples that are easy to laugh at. And maybe our cultural moment has pulled back a little bit from some of those. But if we are mainly either from the right or the left addressing just those sorts of issues, we're liable to miss the deeper current. So anything that becomes so popular in, you know, a matter of months or years is both on the one hand probably not going to last, and yet it's probably, to mix metaphors, it's probably riding some wave of something much deeper. All of that is to lead into this question, which I could see some people saying, okay, this sounds good, and Neil, I appreciate, you know, the work you and Pat have done on this, if those people still appreciate you. I hope they do. But, you know, post-woke, you know, this was great when you were doing this in, you know, COVID in 2020 and 2021. But aren't we in this real conservative resurgence? Aren't we even maybe in a revival? And, okay, good to point this out. But this stuff's pretty passe. Post-woke, we're way past this and helpful to look at it, but we're on to other things. What is the current state of wokeness as you see it?
That's a great question. And I think we should be very hesitant to embrace this triumphalistic narrative. I think the narrative says, well, Donald Trump was reelected in 2024 and he killed wokeness dead. He unalived wokeness. Now, everyone, all the Gen Zers, all the Zoomers are based. They're super right wing. And that demographically is just not true. We have data in our book showing that something like 30% of Gen Zers still claim to be LGBTQ, overt acceptance.
Not just supportive, but they claim
they identify as LGBTQ. Yes, I think we have another survey in 2023. There's a survey of young people, and around 80% of them explicitly said they embrace an oppressor-oppressed framework. And around, again, same number, 80% said they thought Jews were oppressors, for example, that they fit into that framework. Their example after example of, you know, transgender activism has slowed down. But in 2025, in June, there was an op-ed in Newsweek saying that, it was USA Today, saying that transgender women, that is men who identify as women, have no advantage over women in sports. Yes. I mean, remember, we're talking on the outside, there might be this ripple of a resurgence of conservatism. Trump's back in office, etc. But beneath that, you have this huge generation coming of age. We're going to become your next crop of lawyers, doctors, pastors, who are steeped in this woke ideology. So even if it's the sort of feverish manifestations of wokeness are not as visible anymore, it's still under the surface. And what's more, I gotta keep reminding people, in a democracy, we are 4 years away at any given moment from President Gavin Newsom or President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it'd be very naive to say, this is a non-issue, we're done. The last thing I'll say too is that even if the cultural tide shifts against wokeness, it does not mean that individual people in your church or in the community will not be still deeply indebted to these ideas. I mean, just on my street, I saw just a few weeks ago, one of those in this house we believe yard signs went up. It had not been there. And within the last few months, they put up that in this house we believe that Black Lives Matter, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that it sounds like a throwback. You said to COVID era. No, there are people out there that are still being awoken to what they see as a suppressive society. So if we want to, our goal has always been theological. We want to equip Christians to understand why these ideas are not good, and then to reach out to non-Christians who are captivated by these ideas and show them that if you really care about true justice and true human flourishing, you will reject these ideas and embrace the gospel, which gives you a right view of reality.
Really important points. And you talk about even just looking politically, even though, you know, Trump sweeps the purple states and the toss-up states, you know, we're still looking at the last elections for two decades, and these are very narrow margins, just barely a popular majority. And what we're used to may seem like, well, that was, you know, the Republicans won a solid electoral majority. And yet you're absolutely right. This is, even just politically, largely a 50-50 country, with things swinging 2 or 3 points, 1 or 2 points in either direction.
Can I say one other thing too? We wrote our book not entirely, but largely with parents in mind, because if you were going to send your child to a secular college, even a Christian college, unfortunately, they're going to be surrounded by wokeness. I mean, I think Harvard faculty is something like 95% left-leaning. It's like 2% self-identify of Republican faculty, self-identify as Republicans. So the idea that, oh, look, if Republicans were to hold the presidency and Congress and the Supreme Court for the next 30 years, if your kids go into college or university in a state school, they will encounter critical theory in their classes. Their classmates will embrace it. They will be pressured to adopt it. So you have to equip them. You can't assume that because we have the White House now that it's gone. It's not true.
Right. And the Charlie Kirk phenomenon, I think, shows that there is a generation of young people who are hungry for a different message.
Yeah.
And I think much more emboldened to claim, you know, a counter woke idea and to speak it than perhaps 5 years ago. And I think what some of us in conservative Christian circles can sense is maybe in 2020, you know, some more Christian leaders were leaning towards sort of soft towards woke. And I think we see people in those circles mostly pulling back from that, which has been a good thing. But all of that could give us the wrong conclusion that all of this is in the past. Mm-hmm. When, to your point, if you're going to live and operate in this world, and especially, you know, send your kids to 85-90% of the universities or the colleges here, you're going to encounter this. So I want to just zero in a little bit on the, you know, you talk about critical theory. And you say there are four pillars. This is really helpful. One of the things I appreciate about you and Pat in your writing is it's very clear, it's very orderly. You're always trying to quote chapter and verse, both Bible, but you know what I mean, others. And you're trying to be fair, but not pull any punches. So this is really helpful. Four pillars of contemporary critical race theory: social binary, hegemonic power, lived experience, social justice. I'd love for you to walk us through each of those as they describe critical theory.
Sure. So critical theory is an umbrella category that encompasses things like critical race theory, queer theory, postcolonial theory, third wave feminism. But all of these critical social theories have these four pillars in common. So number one, the social binary, which states that society is divided into oppressors and oppressed groups along lines of race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, immigration status, and so forth. So everyone is in one of those two groups or multiple of those groups, but you're either an oppressor or you're oppressed. And people hear that and they think, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm a woman, I'm black, I'm not oppressed. How can you say that? Well, idea number two is hegemonic power. That's the idea that the ruling class, whether it's whites or men or heterosexuals, they impose their values on culture in a way that seems natural and normal and common sense and even God-ordained. So all of us effectively are brainwashed into these systems of oppression, whether it's the patriarchy, white supremacy, heterosexism, Christian hegemony. And because of that, you don't realize you're oppressed. Even if you're black or a woman or disabled, you say, well, I'm not oppressed. Well, it's because you define oppression traditionally in terms of cruelty, tyranny, injustice. But critical theorists have redefined the word oppression to refer to whenever a dominant group imposes their narratives or values and culture, then people that are privileged by that those narratives are in power, and those who are marginalized by that are oppressed. So that's why they can say that the idea that, say, only men should be pastors, that's a form of oppression. The idea that heterosexuality is God's design for the universe, that's oppression. So that's why they can say that 95% of Americans are actually oppressed in one way or another because they're women or they're. So that's how they can get around the fact that most blacks, most women wouldn't say, I'm oppressed. And so then the question is, if all of us are brainwashed into those values and systems of thought, how do we escape? The third idea is lived experience. So through their lived experience of oppression, minoritized groups, women, people of color, queer people, they can wake up. They can see the reality for what it is, and therefore they have the authority to tell the rest of us who are still blinded by these systems how reality actually works. Then the end goal number four of critical theory is and has always been social justice, which critical theorists have redefined to mean the destruction of these hegemonic narratives, these oppressive narratives, so that all groups can share power. So they have sort of this utopian vision of the distant future in which we all can get along. There's equity, diversity, inclusion, etc.
So just some, that's really helpful. Some terms that people may have heard of and are widespread, but help us to understand, what is intersectionality? Are people still using that term?
This is why you should not just firebomb terms, because they can swap out the old terms that are, you know, are controversial and just use new terms. So, you know, but intersectionality goes back to Kimberlé Crenshaw, critical race theorist in 1989, 1991. It's the idea that all of these systems of oppression are interlocking and inseparable. So she said, you know, in her paper, she talked about how we used to see racism and sexism and heterosexism and ableism as all separate, distinct forms of oppression. But actually, they interact in people's daily experience that you can't just separate out and do only anti-racist work or only anti-sexist work. You have to integrate them. And Ibram X. Kendi, who's a prominent anti-racist scholar, says it very clearly in his books. He says things like, you cannot be anti-racist if you are transphobic or homophobic. To be anti-racist is to be anti-capitalist. To be anti-racist is to be feminist. I think those are verbatim quotes from his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. So intersectionality would say, would basically fuse all these different various critical social theories into one seamless garment. you must embrace all these ideas or you're not truly anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, etc.
And then DEI. Mm-hmm. What is DEI? Where did it come from? Has Trump destroyed it and salted the earth with its remains?
This is a great example, right? There's no question that Trump's executive orders did halt the progression of wokeness in our institutions and even reverse it to some extent. But so the Smithsonian had to take down their statements about how whiteness is teaches you that hard work is the key to success, that whiteness is about scientific method. Those things were real and infographic. So they had to take it down, and a lot of places have dismantled their DEI departments. But they can't stop people from teaching these ideas in the classrooms, right? So again, as a DEI, generally speaking, was supercharged critical theory on steroids implemented in the classroom, in the corporations. They had mandatory diversity, equity, inclusion trainings you're going to hear about things like white privilege, white fragility, systemic oppression, heterosexism, etc. At least in public institutions, Trump has made that illegal, at least on paper. But I think we even cited this in the book, but you will still find someone got fired, I think, in North Carolina, I believe, an administrator was caught on camera saying, "We've taken down the word from the website, but I'm going to keep teaching it in my classroom." So I think that's a great example of how merely attacking the language is not sufficient. You have to go after the ideas. And again, we're primarily motivated by theology. We want Christians, even if they're bombarded by these ideas in their training sessions, to just internally think, hey, I know that's not right biblically, and here's why. Regardless of what the culture is doing, we can, as Christians, maintain our biblical perspective.
How do you think through that these ideas become so coded? And there are lots of issues both coded to the right and to the left, and they become, they're almost pre-critical. I don't mean critical theory. I mean pre-intellectual. They're sort of tribal identity markers. You think of I feel sorry for, there's lots of good women in the world named Karen. I know lots of them. But the so-called Karens. Mm-hmm. I think somebody just sent me an article this morning of, white liberal women who were arguing with Iranian protesters who are against the Iranian regime. And these white progressive women are defending it. I mean, how did this happen? Or how did these things become so strongly coded that you said the Queers for Palestine, which makes no sense. The meme out there is it's like chickens for KFC or something. Right. It just doesn't make sense. But how do these things get lined up? And it doesn't just happen on the left, but that's what we're talking about. How do they get lined up as this is now a constituent part of my identity? So I'm gonna, you kind of know one thing about someone, and you think you probably know another 12 things that line up with this person's ideas and activist impulse.
That's a great observation. So there's no question that critical theory historically has been not exclusive, but it's been primarily driven by the left. I mean, Karl Marx was the first true critical theorist, the Frankfurt School in the 1920s and 30s in Germany, the New Left in England and the US. All of these were features of the left, and they were the ones who wholeheartedly bought into critical theory as a vehicle for their radical political activism. There's no question. But you can understand their ideas at a very intellectual level, but there's also sort of a vibe on the ground where you just Helen Pluckers, who's an atheist, a sort of classical liberal who's written a lot about critical theory with her co-author James Lindsay, she compares wokeness as sort of like Victorian rules for etiquette. You just know, you use this hand for this fork and these people are more important than you. They get to sit first. You got to pick that vibe up. You don't have to be taught, oh, well, here are the rules. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4. You go into a room. So today, for example, the vibe is you go into a room, you look around like, oh, I'm the only white male. I got to be quiet. Or that I'm a black woman, but that person's disabled black woman, so I have to defer to her. So you can sit through, you know, chapters and chapters of reading Robin DiAngelo or Judith Butler or Kimberly Crenshaw, but you can also just get plugged into these activist communities where it's just the water they're drinking, the air they're breathing, and you pick it up pretty fast that way. So I think that's true. That I'll be careful. People have not gotten woke because they sat down and read a whole anthology on this stuff. They get woke because they're part of this community, and they learn to mimic and parrot its talking points. And actually, one of the things we say in this book is that's why it's so helpful to sort of not unmask or to unearth the underlying assumptions, because otherwise you're kind of just like, well, is this a vibe? But no. It seems like that sometimes, but really there's a deep underlying substructure that we can actually examine as Christians.
One of the examples, just pop cultural examples that I've had in my mind many times is when I was growing up, there was that famous Dana Carvey Saturday Night Live sketch as the church lady.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, could it be Satan? And it was, you know, just playing on, what was that, 90s, early 90s, maybe? Still some cultural residue of who is that kind of school marm, tut tut, you said the wrong thing, everybody needs to be in place. And it was a church lady. Mm. I mean, you wouldn't have that kind of sketch. Now, Saturday Night Live might not poke fun at, you know, progressive foibles anyways, but we've seen this with comedians who are, you know, comedians are almost by their, not all of them, but many of them by their nature, you know, what they do has to be sort of culturally transgressive. That's part of you just said that. Now we want to be careful not, you know, hitching our cultural wagon to people who, you know, they make people laugh for a living, and that can be a nice, you know, thing to do, but you're good at pointing us to these deeper realities. But I just think of that as an illustration of what has changed and what you're pointing out, this almost Victorian, you know, it's downstream from political correctness. That's not the term people use anymore. Right. But that was an early iteration of there are certain words we can and can't say. There are certain ways of behaving. And some of those rules were maybe very earnestly, sincerely felt by people. Other times, they were their own kind of power play,
right?
To sort of keep out that's what jargon is sometimes, to keep out the uninitiated, to keep out the rubes, the people in flyover country who don't really know how to act and how to think. And what I so appreciate about this book, and really, you know, the work that you've done online, you know, one of the, you know, on Twitter, which I've pretty much stopped doing anything on Twitter, but you still are giving it the old college try on there to be salt and light. And, you know, with your blog and articles and then these books, is you really want to help. And you already said it. You want to help parents and students and Christians. It's not that the political sphere doesn't matter or the cultural vibes don't matter, but this is what we should be thinking as Christian parents and certainly pastors and church leaders. How do we disciple our people? And that's what this book is trying to do. And I want to just talk about some of the ways we might respond. Now, it doesn't always work so neatly that you talk to somebody on your college campus and then you can just do a drop-down menu in your head. And now you have this, you know, 5-minute, really excellent apologetics conversation. But these are the sort of things that people, you know, in a dorm room might stay up late talking about. How can you help people? They're a good Bible-believing, earnest, conservative Christian, and they're trying to defend with their friends what the Bible teaches on these issues, race, gender, sexuality. And they get thrown at them in the first 30 seconds. Well, obviously you're saying that because you're a white, privileged, patriarchal male. What's the next thing that person should do when that dump truck of labels has just been poured on them and you start to think, oh, well, I guess I don't have anything else to say?
Yeah, I mean, and we have a whole chapter on logic, basically, and then showing how that a lot of times we have examples like that, where when people basically approach you with an ad hominem, like you're this thing, you're a bad thing, right? how would you navigate that? So we have many examples in that chapter throughout the book. That one example, when they say, well, you're a straight white male, therefore, you're, whatever you're going to say next is false. There are many different ways to go in that conversation. I'll just give one. The most sort of intellectual approach you could take is to say, well, but sometimes, you know, straight white males like me might by accident hit upon truth. Is that true? So shouldn't we really look at the truth of what I'm saying, whether it's true or false, not who I am? Like, I mean, what if I found a black woman saying the same thing as me? Would you accept it then? So you can sort of point out to them that, you know what? Don't get offensive. Like, well, how dare you? That's racist. Yeah. Just say, hey, let's turn the temperature down and say, yes, that's true, that I will be, my perceptions, my beliefs will be colored, affected by my social location. Sure. And yet, we're really
You know who invented the iPhone that you're looking at right now?
A straight white male.
Yeah. So, yeah, they don't get everything wrong.
Yeah. So you want to gently, kindly point them back to the idea that what matters is the truth of the claim we're discussing, not who offers it. And there is, and we have many different approaches to take. I mean, one thing that's more snarky, I wouldn't recommend doing it right off the bat, but you could say you only believe that because you're a critical theorist.
And yeah.
Point out to them that kind of reasoning is just a logical fallacy. We can't dismiss the truth of someone's statement by who they happen to be or the other beliefs they happen to hold. The statement is either true or false, and we have to then defer to the evidence and to reason to figure out whether it's true or false.
So let's talk a little bit more. And I think this is one species of bulvarism that C.S. Lewis talked about. And I think it's worth explaining. So what did C.S. Lewis mean by bulvarism, and why is it so relevant to this discussion?
It's very relevant. So in the 40s or 50s, Lewis coined the term bulvarism, talking about how atheists will dismiss your claims about God as wishful thinking. And Lewis said, well, whether God exists or does not exist is independent of my desire that he does, right? If I say, here's evidence God exists, they say, well, that's just wishful thinking. See, maybe it is, but here's the evidence. Let's discuss that rather than my own motivations. So we see this reasoning employed, fallacious reasoning, bulvarism, employed a lot by critical theorists. But why? You have to understand, anyone can commit bulvarism. Atheists, Christians, progressives, conservatives, anyone can dismiss a claim on the basis of the person making the claim, their identity, their politics, whatever. But you have to understand that critical theory almost necessitates bulvarism because they assume that your beliefs are determined by your social location. In other words, you've been brainwashed by the ruling class. It's a second pillar of contemporary critical theory, that all of us have been brainwashed by the straight white men who rule society. And therefore, all our beliefs will simply be the product of patriarchal reasoning. This actually goes back to Karl Marx. So although anyone can commit this logical fallacy, it is baked into the critical worldview, and we have to reject that, because if we embrace bad reasoning, all bets are off. We won't believe anything.
Yeah. I mean, so much of what you guys are trying to do is trying to say, let's try to be thoughtful, logical people. And that may seem like tilting
biblical
against windmills.
Too,
Yeah. And sometimes just to get your foot in the door is to say, can we just be logical about this? And then we can get to the biblical. And I like the way you put it, because anyone can remember this. It's very simple to just have in your head, when some of those accusations, just the why versus the what. Mm-hmm. Okay. So and you talk about that in the book, and this happens all the time. And like you said, anybody can do it. It happens that critical race theory is sort of baked into the whole ideology.
Yeah, right.
But you see this all the time. You know, you're saying this because, you know, you have to, this is going to line your pockets.
Right.
You're saying this because this is the last grasp of holding on to whatever sort of power. Or you're saying, so all of those are, they could even be true.
Yeah, maybe they're true. Yeah, you could just, also their strategy is just to say, I admit it, I'm a bigot, hateful, awful person. Now let's ask what the Bible teaches about subject X.
Yeah, right.
So for the sake of argument, I'll accept all of that criticism. Let's then still go and look at the Bible. What does it say?
Yeah, because otherwise you can get sidetracked with a bunch of whys that can't often even be answered, because they deal with the motivations. Yeah. And so return to the what. How would you respond to this, and maybe I've given this illustration before. This is an actual conversation I had. I was talking to doing just a little teaching with a Christian group. These were good people. They agreed with a biblical view of sexuality. And yet, after I did some teaching on it and asked any questions, somebody asked a question. I could tell there was an angle behind it was, okay, I agree with that, but I have two questions for you, Kevin. Have you ever had temptation? Are you ever tempted to same-sex attraction? And can you tell me a few stories about some gay friends in your life? I mean, and this was, friendly fire. And you can very quickly be put on your heels. I mean, and start, what's behind that question? And how does someone respond to that without all of a sudden in some sort of quagmire of having to recount, a litany of and prove that you've known enough gay people in your life to speak meaningfully on this subject?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is just don't get defensive. I mean, that's so disarming when people throw these bombs in there and think they're going to knock you out or get you riled up, and you just say you don't get upset. You remain friendly, you remain kind. What I would say to those questions, so the first question is answering personally. I'd say no, I haven't actually. And then this, but I would say, but does that mean that what I'm saying is not true or that I've handled it unfairly or uncharitably? Well, not necessarily. In the same way, I get something like, racism is wrong, guys. Well, have you ever been tempted by racism? I'd be like, well, not really, but so? Like, it's just wrong, right? So if it's sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. Be consistent. Like, if there's some sin you can't call out unless you've experienced temptation yourself, well, are you consistent on that? Would you not call out racism or the desire to get an abortion? You wouldn't
What
call
about
that out as a sin.
Jesus, who didn't have a sin
Yeah,
nature?
right. You'd never know. So that doesn't seem to work. And then you'd say, well, if you ever, how many gay people have you talked to? And I would say, well, I have talked to some. Maybe I should talk to some more. That's fine. Just say, yeah, you know what? I actually, that can be in our book. We talk about how when we're talking about race or these hot topics, and people and sincere Christians do disagree with us on those topics, get a chance, sit down, have coffee, and get to know them. Maybe you do have blind spots. Who knows? We're all sinners. You shouldn't be threatening like and saying like, no, you have to accept what I'm saying, and that doesn't matter if I've never talked to a black person my entire life. At one level, intellectually, that could be true, but hey, they have a point. So get some, we say, get some receipts in your history when it comes to pushing back against racism and seeking racial justice and learning about our history. Go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in DC. Learn about slavery. Learn about so that, I would just say take the temperature down whenever you can as Christians in a very polarized culture right now. Whenever you have opportunity to calm the conversation down, be charitably kind. And I think that will make your arguments more persuasive if you can you if you are being mature and not being aggressive and throwing it ad hominems.
That's right. And turning it back in a friendly way to the actual question at hand, which, in that case would be the rightness or wrongness of same-sex attraction or homosexual behavior. Because I think you can easily start playing the same kind of intersectional game or the sort of identity game. And I need to have this many gay friends, this many black friends, this many lived experiences. I mean, the person doesn't know they're doing it, but they're really shifting onto some of those four categories of critical theory. And they're saying, can you prove that I should listen to you, that you have enough check marks? So not only, intellectually do I think we shouldn't do that, it also can lead us to look at real human relationships in merely the terms of intellectual
Yeah, it's
commodities.
transactional.
Yeah, it's just transactional, and I need to prove to you where I think, the sort of questions you offer, very disarming to say to someone, I've read a lot on this subject. I've had, the normal sort of range of interactions with a variety of people over the years. Is there something in particular that you think I might be missing?
Yeah,
Is
sure.
there an insight that you think would be helpful for me to understand? And that's going to, and they probably will say, well, I mean, not necessarily. I just want to know if, and then you can maybe have a pleasanter, more fruitful conversation. And I often think of, you know, I got this from Greg Kokol about the pebble in the shoe. When we're having these conversations, it's not usually that the result is someone says, oh, let me repent of wokeness. And my whole way of being brought up and my whole university education has been a waste.
Yeah.
But you give them a pebble. And part of that pebble is really, this is biblical. This is not being cowardly. It's biblical to say, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they will give glory to God on the days that he visits us. Mm-hmm. The logic there is, there's something in the Christian character and demeanor that is different and holy and kind, not cowardly, not a pushover, but all of those things that the person walks away and they think, well, that maybe I will think about that. Mm-hmm. And I got that pebble in my shoe. And it absolutely has to do with not just our intellectual ideas and our courage, but our ability to speak as human beings, one to another. Let me ask one more, and then we'll maybe finish up with just some of these categories. But, you know, you talk about Mott and Bailey. I think last time you were on here, you talked about that. And that's when someone makes a very, you know, extreme statement. I think you say in the book, like, all whites are racist. And then you press them on that, and then they sort of back up. Well, you know, all everyone in America, you know, has some benefit of, you know, a history of slavery or something. And it's, you know, a more modest claim. But how do you deal with this? Because this is also parents, especially friends. This is where it's very hard. And because we do care about people and we really care, especially the closer they are to us. If you're talking about these issues, and this is maybe in particular with the sexuality one, and someone presents themselves as, you know, I find what you're saying so hurtful, so devastating to me personally. They may threaten either implicitly or explicitly self-harm.
Yeah.
These experiences, you have no idea. I've lived my whole life and I've had this, and it's so traumatic. And the sort of person and the even your presence, this is, you know, the rationale sometimes for just canceling speakers, their very presence was violent and offensive. But that particular one, which I think Christians, because we want to care for people, are susceptible to, is the kind of threat, implicit threat of self-harm or the devastation that this will be wrought in this person. How do you deal with that on a heart level?
I think so. There are two approaches. One is like, if I would always assume the person is sincere. Obviously, they can just be using that as a cudgel to get you to shut up. But just, you know what? Assume for the sake of just out of charity that they're being said, they're truly upset and traumatized and emotional because of even your presence. Just let your demeanor speak for itself. Go to them and say, hey, and mean it. I really love you. I'm commanded to love you. Jesus commanded that. And if I'm hurting you by anything that I'm actually doing, then I'm sorry, right? If I'm doing something wrong. But I think you're asking me to not believe things that are actually true, that God says are true. And I can't do that. I'll do anything I can, you know, within the scope of what's true and good to show you that I care about you, that I'm doing this because I love you. But you're asking me then to, if you're asking me to not tell you the truth, I can't do that because I love you. I don't lie to people that I love. So that's one thing. And the other side of that is a very practical one. And when you hear the claim often being made by, unfortunately, even therapists, school counselors, about transgender identified teens, would you rather have a live son or a dead daughter? That's a scare tactic, like, oh, your daughter's going to kill herself unless you affirm her male gender identity. That's the claim often being made. But we know, number one, from research, it's not true that suicide rates do not dramatically get reduced after affirmation of various kind, transitioning to their gender. That doesn't happen, number one. In the contrast, we have detransitioners. We listen to our book. There are now more and more people who identified as transgender, live that way for months or years and then detransition back to their birth gender and are livid because they have done themselves irreparable harm. They've cut off their genitalia. They have taken hormones. They may be sterile now. And they are broken people. And they, some of them have even written blog posts or books or gone on talk shows talking about, why did no one love me enough to tell me the truth? Yes, it's true. Back then, I probably would have yelled at them and written them off as a bigot. But I was a confused kid. And now I've hurt myself in dramatic ways. Where were you who loved me enough to tell me something I didn't want to hear? So I did take that twofold tragedy. One is assure them that you, and should be sincere, you really care about them. But then two, real compassion, true love is rooted in the truth and not in lies. And the example we always give is sort of obvious. If an anorexic girl says, call me fatty, tell me I'm fat, or, and if you don't, I'll never talk to you again. You say to her, it's not, and if you don't call me fat, it's because you don't love me. And you'd say to her, honey, it's because I love you that I will not call you fat. You are killing yourself, and I will do anything I can to show you that you're loved and that, you don't, that this is not true about you. But out of love, you do not lie to them. And so it's not that truth and compassion are at odds. They actually have to go together.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for parents. This is when it gets hard. If you have a child in, you know, wanting to transition or call me a boy when she is a girl, or gay or lesbian, affirm this. And everything in your parent heart is broken and wants to love. And the last thing a parent wants to do is be the source of hurt or pain in the life of a child. And yet we do understand as parents that, well, really, when if we could step back from these particularly loaded cultural issues, we'd all recognize a parent who never, you know, never is the source of some discipline or pain or hard truth in the life of a child is a very bad parent. No boundaries, no rules, especially when you're young or you're going through puberty, you're trying to figure things out. This is when you most need a loving parent. And I think just, you know, this isn't the conversation you maybe have with your 15-year-old and you talk about, you know, philosophical terms like moral agency, but we need to understand that there is moral agency, and we are responsible for the things we say. We're responsible for the way in which we talk to others. We're responsible as Christians for having Christ, you know, Christ, Christian truth, Christ-like demeanor. And we are not responsible for how everyone may receive everything that we say. Now, there's a nuance there because, you know, Proverbs says you don't want to be like a madman shooting firebrands and deadly arrows and says, I was only joking. There are some things you can imagine, well, how is that going to land? And yet, if we are so circumscribed in what we say and do and how we parent, by what the child or the teenager or the student may think and respond, we're not honoring them as image bearers who have a moral agency, who are making their own decision. I mean, the person who says, if you don't come to my, you know, the wedding, this gay wedding, you don't love me, I will write you out of my life. And sometimes we say, well, the parent doesn't want to burn bridges. Well, the parent isn't the one burning that bridge.
Right, yeah.
The parent is the one, you know, holding to a biblical fidelity on this issue. So just give, as we kind of try to bring this to a close, on race, gender, and sexuality, what word of encouragement do you have to parents in particular who are trying to disciple and love their children in ways that seem so scary? I think that's part of our cultural moment that we don't want to overlook. I mean, a lot of understandably sincere Christians are really scared by this stuff and they need a lot of help. What do you want to say to those Christians?
I think the first thing I'd just say is trust in God's sovereignty, right? You serve a good God. You serve a God who's more gracious than we can imagine, who pursues lost people. So don't feel like it's all on your shoulders. I mean, I have many examples I can think of people who've lost their kids to wokeness. Yes, that's true. And it's heartbreaking. That's why Pat and I wrote this book, because we want to equip parents so that they don't have to deal with. But on the other hand, we also know stories of parents who did equip their kids well, and their kids still either wandered away or really close to the edge. So it's not all on your shoulders. Like, the, you know, kids are there, have their own moral agency. They make their own choices, and you can train them and teach them. We can do our best to train them as parents and to give, to show them what's true and beautiful, but they can still turn away. And if they do, God can still bring them back. So it's not all on you. Do your best, but then pray to our sovereign God, because he's compassionate and merciful and brings people home.
Mm, that's a wonderful word. Okay, I have one more question. And this could be the whole podcast for another time. But I do think it's an important question. You and I have both written on this some. So my final question, we've been talking about these dangers on the left, so to speak. And I do think they are particularly culturally powerful and in elite corridors. Is there, however, such a thing as the woke right? And maybe don't even, we don't have to fight over the label, though you've used it and I've used something similar. So what is that danger, and what word do you want to say to those who may be drawn to that kind of wokeness coming from the right?
Yeah, this is a very online phenomenon for the most part, but it is a real phenomenon, and it's growing. Forget the terminology. What I would say is this is why it's so important to recognize the ideas as bad and unbiblical, because if all you focus is the politics, the outcome of the ideas, like, well, I can recognize left-wing wokeness in Drag Queen Story Hour or, you know, Queers for Palestine. I see that and I reject that. But if you don't understand the ideas, if it comes in a different form, clothed in a right-wing garb, you might embrace it. Unfortunately, we're seeing that in some niche corners of the internet. I've done a lot of reading on this. And the term woke right, you've talked about, you kind of used it, I've used it. Joel Berry, the editor for the Babylon Bee, used it. James Lindsay, the author of Cynical Theories. These are all people that are very much opposed to left-wing wokeness. All of us seemingly independently came up with this term woke right. I kid you not. I've talked to these guys because we were seeing people that are ostensibly on the right who were espousing these exact same critical theory ideas, like the social binary and hegemonic power and lived experience and the needs for radical social transformation. All the components were there, but they were approaching them from this radically right leading perspective. So I then went, after seeing this phenomenon, I went to the literature. You can see my shelf back there. I have a whole shelf now of radical right books. And it turns out that, yes, indeed, in the 60s, concurrent with the new left that was injecting critical theory into social discourse, there was a group in Europe that called themselves the Nouvelle Droite, which is French for the new right. And they overtly said they wanted to create basically a neo-Marxism of the right. And they were embracing Gramsci, Horkheimer, Foucault. They were embracing all these same left-leaning, very leftward radicals. But they were repurposing their ideas for an assault from the right on society. We are seeing that today in certain circles and even in certain Christian evangelical circles. So my only point there is this. Spot the ideas. The ideas are bad and unbiblical. You can't start saying that all these ideas are demonic, unbiblical, when the left uses them, but they're just fine. When conservatives use them, they're never fine. They're always fallacious. They're always bad. They're always simplistic. So that's just something to be on guard of. And again, the key to it is just understanding why these ideas are unbiblical, and that will let you then reject them, whether they're pervaded by the left or the right.
Right. So if for one, it's you're a patriarchal oppressor, someone else, it may be you're an elite squish.
Yeah.
I mean, same kind of, you
you
don't
only
understand.
Say that because you're going to curry favor with the regime, right? You only say that because you're a white man.
You're a regime evangelical. Exactly. All of these things, which again, the same kind of response would be in order. Kindness, love, Christian charity, and okay, is there something I'm missing? Or let's talk about the what, rather than being so sure of the why, or embracing these as tribal identity markers before and above and sometimes beyond, you know, well, what does the Bible say about it? Mm-hmm. So it sounds cliche, But the Bereans, it's really true. I mean, open our Bibles, look at the scriptures, be shaped by the word of God, and see where there is bad thinking, unbiblical thinking, wherever it exists, because God is going to be most honored when we are sticking most steadfastly to his word. And that means how we live and how we treat others and how we think and how we assess these. These are the issues that God in his providence has given us. Different age might be something else, but the issues of race, gender, and sexuality are not going away, and Christians need to be equipped to think carefully and biblically about them. So I'm grateful to Neil and Pat for Post-Woke, Asserting a Biblical Vision of Race, Gender, and Sexuality. Once again, my blurb on the front. If someone asks me what is wokeness, what is wrong with it, this is the first book I'll recommend. So I encourage our listeners to pick this up. It just came out, Neil.
Tomorrow officially launches, but yeah, you can order it now.
So probably by the time that this airs in a few days, the book will be out. So keep up the good work. Good to be with you, Neil.
My pleasure, Kevin.